Welcome to Autism Conversations, a podcast by the Autism Programs at the University of New Mexico Center for Development and Disability. I am Savannah Oster, and I am happy to be here to introduce today's podcast titled Imagine Living Your Best Life, a Self-Advocate Panel. Today, we are so grateful to be sharing with you a segment from the Imagine Workshop, which was put on this month by the autism programs at the UNM Center for Development and Disability. In this panel discussion, we will hear from an incredible group of individuals who discuss their journeys, share their stories, and offer guidance through their lived experiences. We sincerely thank each of them for sharing their wisdom with us and for allowing us to collaborate with the Imagine Autism Virtual Workshop Series to bring this podcast to you today. So let's get started.
Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Imagine Planning team, I would like to thank you for being here today to share some of your experiences with how each of you live your best life. Before we begin our discussion, let's get started with some introductions. My name is Debbie Montana. I am a program specialist with the autism programs at the UNM Center for Development and Disability. Let's start with Savannah.
Hello, my name's Savannah Oster, and I am a office assistant at the CDD, and I help autism programs with trainings I do, and I help support our division.
Thank you, Savannah. And Amelia Ann.
Good afternoon. My name is Amelia Ann Dickey. I am an adult with a different ability, and I'm excited to share my knowledge with the world. I also hold many roles, too, which are leadership positions within the disability and advocacy community. Thank you for allowing me to speak to you today.
Thank you. And Jesse?
Hi, my name is Jesse Calero. I'm excited to be here. I work for an organization called the New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty, and my background is in fundraising. I'm excited to talk today. I'm an adult woman with autism, and so I'm excited to talk about my experience and share that with you all.
Thank you. Laurel.
Hi, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Laurel Deans. I'm the ARC of New Mexico, directors at large with them, and I'm with the Center for Self-Advocacy with the Planning Council, and I work with horses, and I help with my mom with her school.
Thank you, Mikey.
Hello, everyone. My name is Mikey Swalby. I am an office assistant at the CDD. I am a person with autism, and I've just been living here in New Mexico for pretty much my whole life.
Thanks, Mikey. And last but not least, Josh.
Hi, everyone. My name is Joshua. I am an adult with autism that currently works at the Rio Rancho Library. And I've been living in Rio Rancho, New Mexico since I was six. And I'm very happy to share what I know and give advice on how to live.
Great. Well, we're so happy to have all of you here. Let's go ahead and get started with the first question with regard to diagnosis. How do you think the timing of when you were diagnosed with ASD has affected your life? In other words, receiving a diagnosis as a child versus as an adult. So we'll start with Savannah.
I received my diagnosis with autism. I was 2.5 years old, and I actually got diagnosed here at the CDD. I find it that I got diagnosed at the perfect timing because then I got early intervention and I got school-based services as well. And I got SLP and OT. I got PT for a brief time. It didn't last very long because I didn't need physical therapy. and I was able to do hypnotherapy at 3. So it really worked out perfectly for me because then I got the SLP help and the OT help, and that's when I was able to like function the way that I hope to function because the person that told my mom I was never going to be able to talk. That's not true because I'm talking now. And we thought I wasn't ever going to be able to talk because I had a really hard time when I was little. I was trying to learn how to speak. And when I got older, the services paid off because I was able to then get accommodations in high school, able to get accommodations in college. And I learned how to speak for myself and I learned how to just advocate more for me. And I learned more as an adult because my special education teacher, thanks to her for helping me in high school, be able to advocate for myself. And I had to learn how to do as an adult based on what I got in high school. And we will be touching base on accommodations in the workplace later, but the skills I got it from was from high school. And so I was like confused as a kid with AST because I wasn't told until I was in high school. So I was like, why am I getting all these services? I knew something was going on. It's just my mom and dad told me in high school that I had autism, and ever since they told me it made sense to me.
Thank you so much for sharing. Sounds like you had some amazing supports in high school. That's wonderful. Thank you, Savannah. Joshua, same question.
Okay, so this question, it's complicated for me to answer because I didn't fully know what autism really, really, really meant until I was just starting high school. But I was diagnosed, thankfully, in middle school, or officially in middle school, but I was being tested when I was in elementary school to see how things were going. And I had my head in the clouds a lot with a lot of things I did. I always did my own thing. I always kept saying that things are different than they were, but I didn't fully understand why I was thinking differently than others. I knew I was different, but I didn't know exactly in what way, in what context. And it wasn't until I started going to occupational therapy in middle school that I first heard the word autism and started developing tools and skills to try to hone myself and become more mentally and spatially aware of myself that I started becoming more than I was. I started paying attention better in school. I started developing a better sense of self. Something that was already there, but just more reeled in, more controlled. And I'm actually extremely, extremely grateful for all the people that helped, my mom, my sister, my speech therapist, and my occupational therapist that helped me develop the tools and skills needed for me to like say what I needed and for me to open up and actually be there, because it's been hard doing it on my own. I'm still very guarded with a lot of stuff, and I think it's easier as a it's just my opinion, but I think it's probably easier if you get diagnosed at a younger age. That way, as you grow and develop, you can have a better grasp of yourself when you reach adulthood, because you're still developing.
I love how you answered that. And you know how you were talking about being different. Well, you know, I always learned that being different is a good thing. It means that you're being brave enough to be yourself. And
It is,
that's
that's true.
good. Yeah, that's a good thing in your case, Josh. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Laurel, you're up.
Okay. I found out I had disability autism when I was 2, and so I grew up with a disability, and it was hard for me because a lot of appointments I had, speech and counseling and tutoring and special ed. So yeah.
Yeah, and I bet you found that those things probably helped you at that age to create the amazing person that you are now, right? Thank you for sharing, Laurel. And Mikey?
I was diagnosed when I was around the age of three, and I think being diagnosed at that time helped me because it allowed for my family and my support group to kind of know and start looking for proper resources and stuff, how to kind of try to how to explain it to other people and how I saw explain myself, and also kind of helped me because it allowed me to go and learn how to just acknowledge that I have autism and not be ashamed or like nervous about telling people about it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. You know, I have the pleasure of working with you, and I learn so much from you every day. So you had a great support system for sure. Let's see here. Jesse?
It sounds like I have a slightly different experience than the other panelists. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 27. And what had sort of prompted my interest in looking at what was going on, I had just experienced a really difficult divorce, and I was raising a little boy on my own. And just felt like there was probably something wrong with me, that things were so difficult. Like, I just always felt like, why are things that are so simple for other people so incredibly difficult for me? And because I wasn't diagnosed at a young age, I had really internalized a lot of shame and feeling like I was clearly broken, or, a lot of negative ableist terms, like saying I'm stupid, things like that. I feel like because I was diagnosed later in life, I'm having to do a lot of work to unlearn a lot of that internal monologue I've created in my head, that, that I'm deficient in a lot of ways or don't measure up. And so finally getting diagnosed, I remember the person who was diagnosing me saying, I feel excited for you to tell you what the testing and what our conversations have led to. And he sort of prepared me. He was like, I don't know how you'll react. And I immediately burst into tears and explained to him, like, it was not a sadness or any sort of disappointment or anything like that, that it was like this huge relief of understanding that my brain works differently. And so all of those things that I had told myself of how I was stupid, how maybe I didn't care about other people or didn't handle things right, that maybe those things weren't true, that maybe I'm just sort of a square peg constantly forcing myself into a round hole. And I think I could have really used a lot of support and a lot of that message as a child, that I wasn't crazy, that I wasn't just difficult for the sake of being difficult. I dealt with a lot of sensory issues, and I don't think even I understood what those issues were. And so I think other people just saw me as like just a really difficult child, like always crying, always being overwhelmed. Like there were some environments where I would really thrive and go above and beyond in, and other environments where I really, really struggled in. And I think because of the way I present to the world, it was assumed that I was doing something purposefully to just make life hard in some way. And I think if I had been given a little bit of support, maybe I could have understood like why hearing electricity is really difficult for me, or why being in certain environments is painful, or that it wasn't just me being a problem. And I think I probably could have learned some coping mechanisms instead of doing what I was doing, which was trying to muscle through difficult situations, hitting my limit and melting down, which I still find myself doing sometimes. instead, like figuring out what support I need, how can I adapt a situation to make it like livable and maybe even comfortable for me. I think I get a little jealous of people who could maybe access some of those things, and I think it's difficult no matter what. But sometimes I wonder how my skills would be different or how life may have been easier if I had known sooner.
Wow, that's very powerful. Thank you, Jesse, for sharing that with us. It's always interesting to hear different perspectives. So I appreciate that. And you're a very, very strong woman, I will say that. Amelia Ann, I know that you wanted to add to this.
Yes. So I very seldom will talk about or admit that I have a disability. I'm trying to focus more on my abilities and my strength. I am grateful for all the support I still have and still receive. Because of the moment I came out of the womb, I had constant services and therapies, interactions. That's kind of why I am how I am today, is constantly wanting to be involved in things, doing things, constantly be busy, and constantly be going 100 miles an hour. Like Jesse mentioned, I have a toolbox that sometimes I'm not as good as that 15. When I get sensory overload, if I can feel some, I can feel myself getting sensory overload, I'll try to reference that toolbox. But sometimes it's too late, and I'm already into a sensory meltdown before, and then trying to reference my toolbox and take longer to decompress when I don't. Trying to stop it before it escalates.
I understand. I'm glad that you have those tools and you know how to navigate those feelings that you were just explaining. I'm sure it's very challenging at times, but it sounds like you have it under control. That's really
Yeah,
awesome.
and especially because of being isolated for so long. It's almost like I'm having to relearn how to be out in society again.
That makes sense. Thank you for sharing. All right, so let's move on to the next question. How do you build your social network of support? Who is in your network? How important do you think those connections are? For this question, let's start with Jesse.
This is definitely a difficult question because, as an autistic person, I always really struggled with making and keeping friends. One thing I've learned is that life is a lot easier if you can find other neurodivergent people to be around because they're going to get it better than anyone else, and they're not constantly worried about social rules that neurotypical people are really committed to and hung up on. It's a lot easier to build those relationships with other people like you. And so, not to say I avoid neurotypical people. We all have to deal with them, unfortunately. And of course, I'm being sarcastic, but I think it's important to find other people who can understand what you're experiencing and who can support you. In a way that's very unconditional. My family has been a huge support to me, even when they don't understand me. I know that they love me. And I have a partner of just over a year who has become just a really critical part of my life and who really provides that unconditional support and understanding. And even though he may not always understand me either, I think that's probably the most important criteria to find among your social network is even when this person may not understand what I'm experiencing or why I'm reacting a certain way, are they going to show up for me? And say, what can I do to help, or how can I help you, or figure out a way to support you rather than dismissing you or saying what you're experiencing isn't valid or right or normal. So that's what I would contribute.
Thank you. I appreciate you adding that. We'll go ahead and move on to Joshua.
Okay. All right. So having a social network, I definitely think is really important. Because not only can that social network be a safety net if you need help, I mean, that network is something you have to like build up over time, with people that can support, that can help, that can like. Think of a social network as a resource, something that you can use and adjust if need be to help you learn to live life. Because if you have, I think I already said this. I think just having a social network is a really good, so is a really good just safety net overall. I mean, I am probably the last person to ever give any social advice. I mean, I only have one friend. I don't have too many. I'm not very great at making new ones, but I think if you have pe people, advisors, if you have friends who go through things, if you have friends that don't go through the same things, if you have a network of diversity, resources, or anything like that, it would make everything a lot easier to function, to live, and to interact with many others. And I think it's very useful.
I couldn't agree more. I don't know what I would do without my support group and my social connections. You nailed it. Thanks, Josh. And Amelia Ann.
So, like I mentioned earlier, I have always had, I still do have a wide range of social network. I have a lot of support. And I've had since the time I was born. And some of the ways I build them is by treating others the way I want to be treated and connecting to those who share my same passion. And believe it was Jesse that mentioned that it's easier to hang out with those who share your same struggles. I notice I'm more open and more comfortable talking when I'm around people that are my same age or share the same struggles that I do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. Savannah, did you want to add anything?
I would. So for me, how I build my social network of support is in the environment I'm in, such as work, such as church, and in places I go. I have gotten plugged in into small groups at my church and gotten to know my fellow coworkers here. I'm very thankful for you guys and all of you. And I have made friendships over the years at church and at wherever I go, and friendships are super duper important to me, and connections are very important because they help you through very difficult times. They help you through good times, and you can be yourself, and you want friends who are true to their word and someone who's always there for you no matter what you go through. And so those are just super duper important to me, and they support you through exciting times and the challenging times, and that's to me is super important. And the connections are very, very important.
Yes, I agree. I think those are all important characteristics when you are forming your support group. Absolutely. Thank you, Savannah. Okay, so the next question. Oh, I'm sorry, Jesse, did you have something you wanted to
I was
add?
just going to add just one other quick
Sure.
thing. I think
Absolutely.
One thing I didn't think about, and I think is important to say, and especially as there are like parents and other people with disabilities watching this, is that we as autistic people also are critical in those social networks in supporting others. And I feel like sometimes we, as like a person with a disability, are like, oh, I need social networks to support me. And I think people should recognize that we also provide really important support to others. And sometimes we're able to show up in ways that others aren't. You know, I think about like someone experiencing grief or something like that. Like a neurotypical person might show up and just be like talking, talking, talking. Whereas like someone like me, I might just sit there and just listen and just sit in the quiet and witness what they're experiencing and support them. And so I want to like sort of celebrate and advocate for, you know, if you have a child with a disability, if you have a disability, that we give back to our communities and support our networks as well, maybe in some non-traditional ways, but that it's still valid and important.
Very good. Thank you. I'm glad that you added that. That was really good to hear. Thank you, Jesse. Let's see here. The next question: what does it mean to be independent to you? And how do you create a balance between independence and interconnectedness? Meaning, when you ask for help from your friends and your inner circle. So we'll go ahead and start with Mikey.
How I view independence is being able to make decisions for myself. And sometimes that involves me doing things by myself and not having others there. And sometimes it's having, you know, there can be someone from my support group there, but I'm still sort of leading what I need and what sort of resources I do. And how I try to balance that is just trying to be open and honest with them and hope having them be the same way with me. And also trying to set like healthy boundaries just to make sure that they don't accidentally overstep or anything, because that sometimes can be a kind of a problem when trying to be independent.
Absolutely. Thank you for reminding me about boundaries. That is so important. Thank you, Mikey. Laurel, what does being independent mean to you?
Well, independent means I can certainly things do by myself, like washing dishes, making salad, cleaning my bird's cage. And I'm independent going to the stable, borrowing my mom's car, but I have to be really careful with my mom's car because it's her car. And getting around the store and going to counseling and appointments and spending money.
You are a busy lady. I was reading about all the things that you do, and I get tired just reading about it. So, yes, you are a very independent young lady. Thank you. Thank you for sharing, Laurel. And Savannah.
Me being able to take care of yourself, being able to provide for yourself financially, provide like groceries for yourself, is how I view it as, and being able to do chores for yourself and be able just to do general hygiene for yourself and being able to, I know like not everyone can do this, but it's like, so even driving your own car to work or something, driving yourself, and that's what, and I drive myself, and also just being, it just depends, and you can, even if you don't drive a car, you can be independent by going on a train or going on a bus or something by yourself. So that is also another way, in taking Uber somewhere. Like I've done Uber before out of town. So just those kind of things. And for me, depending on the situation, I can take care of myself. There are times than others, depending on the season I'm in, I lean on my friends and family through transportation or through or through just emotional support, just through like natural supports I need, and my friends and family are always there for me. And just you're taking care of yourself when you lean on those supports also, and you're also taking care of yourself also when you're there for other people, because when you're there for other people, then you are able to help them. That only doesn't help them, but it also helps you. It makes you feel much better, and it heals you too.
Oh, I love that. That's right. I always feel better when I'm helping someone else. And it's a win-win, right? Thank you so much for sharing. We're going to go ahead and move on to the next question. What are your thoughts on an individual disclosing their disability in the workplace? If they choose to, what do you think is the right timing? Would it be at the interview or after they've been at the job for a while? So we're going to go ahead and start with Amelia Ann.
So I personally don't my thoughts on an individual disclosing a disability in the workplace is it should be entirely up to the individual and their comfort level.
Thank you. That's great. Thank you very much. And how about Laurel?
Oh, I didn't know I was expecting that answer to that question, but okay.
Want me to skip you? We don't have to. I could skip to somebody else.
I can go and
Okay.
skip someone else.
No worries. Okay. How about Savannah? What are your thoughts on an individual disclosing their disability in the workplace?
In my personal opinion, I completely strongly recommend disclosing your disability as soon as you apply for your job, as soon as you get interviewed, because then when you start working that way, your employer, your supervisor can work with you to get accommodations. I know that's going to be mentioned later too, the accommodations. That way you can work to get accommodations that way, and that way they can understand what you need to help you be successful in a workplace. And that's the reason, because I like to be successful anywhere I am. And so I do disclose my disability all around. That way people understand me better. That way people can. And I do it too, just to help them understand like a different perspective for neurodivergent. And so that's why I disclose my disability everywhere.
Thank you for sharing, Savannah. And we'll go ahead and go to Joshua.
I think that I think it's very important that to disclose your disability, honestly, during the interview. That way, if you are a potential hire, your employer will know who they're hiring, what your disability is, and what they could probably do to help, or whatever, or what your limits could be, or if you need help on anything, you would ask for it. Basically, so they know not to just throw everything at you at once.
I like that. So just being upfront and honest during the interview. I think that's great. Thanks. I appreciate that. And Jesse, last but not least, what are your thoughts on an individual disclosing their disability in the workplace?
I agree with what Amelia Ann said of it, it will vary based on the person and how comfortable they feel. Personally, I disclose that in the interview, but I also have to recognize that I'm in a position of a lot of privilege in terms of, on an application, they're going to see my educational background and my work history and all of these things that sort of recommend me and that I can present as fairly neurotypical. I'm white, heterosexual, cisgender. And so with that, it's like it's not intersecting with other identities that could create hesitancy in an employer. I have friends who are also autistic who don't disclose their disability to many people at all just because they feel like it just adds that other thing that then this employer has to navigate or feel or potentially not select them because of I have a friend who has talked about how, as a Black woman who's also part of the LGBTQ community, she feels like she's masking a couple of different things at once all the time in life. Trying to fit in as sort of the other person in terms of her race, in terms of her sexual orientation, in terms of her being neurodivergent. And so not disclosing that kind of eliminates this one area of anxiety of like, is this just another thing that's going to create like another barrier for me? And so I think those are things to consider is, as people with disabilities, we know what the employment data says of like a lot of people just are intimidated by or have misconceptions about or are scared of hiring a person with a disability. And so, I think those who can disclose and are in a position of privilege, hopefully we're opening some doors so that neurotypical people aren't like, oh my gosh, this is so terrifying. They see that like, okay, this is a really normal experience, and creating an inclusive workforce really benefits my entire team. So hopefully we're opening some doors. But I also wouldn't fault anyone who chooses not to disclose because of a fear of discrimination of some kind, or just because of their own comfort level.
Oh, that was beautifully said. Thank you so much, Jesse. We're going to move on to the next question. So, Mikey, what is the best way to approach when asking for accommodations in the workplace? Would this be at the interview or after being at the job for a while? What is your opinion?
I would think that if you wanted supports and the workplace and stuff, it'd be a good idea to go and talk about those during the interview and the boarding process, because that gives more time for the resources to be acquired and whatever kind of supports you need to be set up. And in the interview, because sometimes interviews, they tell you also about the workplace as much as you're trying to tell yourself to the workplace. Depending on how they react, it might tell you whether or not they will actually honor those like needs you have to be efficient in the workplace and not. And if later on with the supports and stuff, if you need to change them, you can work on that later down the line. Like, hey, I requested that instead of a 15-minute break, I get an hour break during my work day to help me regulate. But then I figure out that maybe I just need 30 minutes. You could try to do that and maybe fact of the job that you didn't consider until later. Once you actually started doing it, and you realize that you need that specific support there too.
I like the insights that you brought up. That's so true. You never know. You could try it out and be flexible and see if maybe you don't quite need the hour. The 30 minutes was just right. That's great. Thanks, Mikey. And Savannah, same questions.
For me, I recommend, based on my own life experience, it's different for everyone, but for myself, I think it's really important, like we were talking about earlier in the interview, to disclose your autism even in an interview. That way they kind of get a sense of what your accommodations will be when you start working. And I think after being a while there, just in the workplace, just because that way, just after a little bit, so we can get used to the environment, that we get used to what environment the workplace looks like, and then eventually mention the accommodations that you need to help be successful, and also bringing it up at the appropriate time also is really important too. And I think, and two, and always ask for supervisors' advice because they're really good, especially where we are. And so I recommend just talking to your supervisor and recommend just letting them know what you need to help you succeed as soon as you. It's one of the earliest things I advise to people is to just ask, just to let them know what you need to help you be successful. And also you get to also getting to know yourself in a workplace for a little bit is a good idea as well before next steps. And depending on where you work too, it just depends on the environment, depends. But for in this case, for my own life experience, I get used to it for a little bit and then I bring up what I need to help myself when it's time.
Yes, I can attest to that. You're very good about speaking up and saying what you need, and that is so important for all of us, right? We're going to go ahead and go to the next question. Laurel, what would you say is the best way to approach difficult situations that come up in the workplace, particularly ones involving other coworkers?
Well, right now I'm not having typically at my workplace at the stable with the horses. I are my coworkers, but I will ask my boss if I need to do anything and we talk about it.
Yeah, that's so important. Having a good relationship with your boss and feeling like you can be open and honest is so important. Thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Same question goes to Savannah. What is the best way to approach difficult situations that come up in the workplace?
Thank you. First, my advice to you all is first communicate the difficult situation that involves other coworkers about the situation with that coworker. Like, just kind of try to work it out yourselves at first, just that way you both, that's the whole point of working is working together as coworkers. If it doesn't resolve the first time, and then if it continues after a while after the coworker and you talk, and then the next appropriate step to take is to let your supervisor know. And if the coworker and get a supervisor involved only when it's appropriate to do it, just try to work out with your coworker first. And then after a bit, if the person that you're having difficulties with and this and they don't listen to the supervisor, then get their a worst case scenario, only if it's a worst case scenario, then get their manager involved if it has to happen. But it's very rare it happens, but it can happen. So that's only go to their boss's boss, go to the person that oversees the division or CEO, whoever may be at your workplace, and then state exactly what's going on and then report it to the manager on site. And if a supervisor's not there while the situation happens, and then just report it to the manager on site, then text or call your supervisor to let them know. That particular thing, if it gets worse, worst case scenario, it's rare. These things do happen, and that with the difficult situation. And the reason it's really important to document your situation, regardless, is that way documentation will show proof that it's true, and they'll be able to deal with that situation.
Great answer. I love that. Yeah, keeping that those lines of communication open with the managers. Yeah, that's so important. Thank you so much for sharing. And then Mikey, what do you say about the best way on approaching difficult situations in the workplace?
My opinion is similar to Savannah's. Basically, sometimes you can just work it out just as coworkers, and sometimes it's all just can be attributed to miscommunication, right? Like, if you can try to open up a dialogue and try to make it fix it that way, such as, hey, thanks for helping me on this slideshow. However, I think we should go and try to make all of the fonts for the body paragraphs, something maybe like Times New Roman, so it's a constant kind of theme for it, and maybe that'll sell it. And if you can't, or if there's something much more serious than just a simple like miscommunication or just misunderstanding, then you can go to your supervisor in HR to try to solve it, because you should be able to feel safe in the workplace, and you need to have like a safe and respectful workplace to be productive for your work. So.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. You're absolutely right. Respect and appreciation. And being felt like you could go talk to someone and that they will hear you. That's great. Thanks, Mikey. All right. So let's move on to the next question, which has to do with your living situation. So we'll go ahead and start with Jesse on this one. Jesse, describe your own living space. What is it like to live on your own? What is it like living with your family? Do you have a roommate or a partner? How do you navigate sharing the space? How do you find the right fit for a roommate or partner? I know that's a lot.
I was going to say, those are a lot of
You can touch
good
base on
questions.
one or two. Yeah.
So I live with my partner and my son, who's 8. And I've definitely always liked living on my own versus living with family or even a roommate. Those were things that were always difficult for me. I like things the way I like them and have an order and want things to be where I put them so that when I look for them, they're right there. And so that's something I've had to adapt to in having a partner. But I also think in looking for a partner, I tried to find someone who really sort of complemented the way I work. Like, for example, I really, really struggle with executive functioning around cooking and shopping for food and things like that. That is like so foreign and difficult, and it's like another language. I can't just like whip up a recipe like some people. It is just such a source of anxiety and stress for me, but I love to clean and do laundry and things like that. And so that's how we balance things. Like, he makes most of the meals and meal preps when he's not home, and I, do all his laundry and clean all the bathrooms and stuff like that. And we like that balance. He doesn't want to clean. I would rather just roll over dead than cook. And so I was really able to find someone who compliments me. And also, we are both very comfortable doing our own thing. I think I always felt like in the past, partners were kind of like, oh, pay attention to me. Like, oh, let's hang out. Like, let's always be together. And I think I thought I was weird or something was wrong with me, that I was always like, okay, I would like some space and I need to be my own person for a while. But I think if you find the right person, they'll be cool with that. Or if you need someone who's very around all the time, find someone who matches with that. I do think one of the hardest things about navigating sharing a space is just with my son. He is also neurodivergent, but is exactly opposite to me. I'm very sensory sensitive and he is very sensory seeking. So everything that triggers me and is upsetting to me, he wants. So loud noises and jumping off of things and scaring people and jumping out of cupboards and running and shouting, and like those are the things that fuel him and help him feel better. And I'm like, can we just sit in a sensory deprivation tank for a month? So as a parent, I think that has been very difficult to learn how to meet his needs and also give myself some sanity. But in looking for a partner, I would encourage everyone, whether it's a roommate, whether it's a romantic partner, to be very, very picky and to not be ashamed of needing to be picky. I think being picky pays off in the long run of having what you need and meeting the needs of your partner and not feeling like you're less than because they don't feel like you're doing something that they deeply need, or you feel like your needs are not being prioritized.
Thank you. Sounds like you have a very methodical way of making
I make
choices.
it sound like a math problem, but I'm
No,
like, you should
not at
create
all.
a spreadsheet and then see how they measure up in the spreadsheet. No, but.
It works. Thank you, Jesse. Amelia Ann, same question. Can you describe your own living space and how you navigate that space?
Sure. So currently, I'm still living at home. However, Back in 2012 to 2015, I did live on my own in the dorms of the ENMU campus. ENMU campus in Radwa. And I liked it so much the first year. Then I went back a second year and then did the same thing for a third year. And probably would still be down there if my health, if I didn't have some downslope during my last year. But it currently I'm living with my family, and but it's also but also has challenges, especially being together pretty much 24/7 the last 3 years. Prior to the pandemic, at least 3 or 4 days a week, I was out in the community doing activities or programs. And but now I'm home a lot more, so it's starting to do a lot of head bumping. But it's always been in the back of my mind, and starting to poke his head up towards the surface is beginning that process of maybe in the nest and kind of having my own space and my own space to spread my wings.
Yeah, having your own space is so important, right? It's kind of going back to those boundaries that we talked about earlier. Thank you so much for sharing. Joshua, you mind going next? How you describe your own living space and how you navigate it?
Okay, so I currently live with my mom and my little sister. And I navigate by shutting myself in my room and not ignoring the entire world. I'm kidding, no, that's a joke. But I basically navigating living with other people, you really need to try to focus on what works for you, but also what works for them. You have to operate as a team when you're living with someone else. Like, let's say, for example, and as a wild example, you're planning on making dinner for someone or your other friends or roommates or whoever you're living with. And so you get all the ingredients done, you make it, and then you set everything out, and they already went to dinner with someone else. There's the whole fact of communication and letting them know your plans and know you want to do something for them, or letting them know that you're here if you want to talk. Just you're supposed to coexist when living with someone else and operate, okay, not cleanly, not everyone's perfect. But I'm trying to find that right word here. Tolerate seems a little bit too condescending, but just function with that person, whether it's a family member or a friend or a partner, you have to learn to just coexist.
That makes sense. And thank you for describing that. Yes, you have to try to make accommodations for each other and be flexible and meet each other halfway. Totally, I get it. We're going to go ahead and just skip to the last question because we're running out of time. I'm going to ask one of you, any one of you, just raise your hand when you want to answer it. What do you know now that you wish you knew when you were younger? Savannah?
What I wish I knew when I was younger is that what I knew when I was younger is I wish other kids were more accepting and inclusive in school, because I had personal experience of not being included as much as I wished I was. And I also wish to be more aware of feelings with trauma I faced as a child as well into adulthood, because I started experiencing trauma when I got older and when I, from my childhood. and I did not think of years ago. So I wish I would have, like, I know I was young, and so I do give myself grace because I didn't understand, comprehend when I was a kid. And I also wish we could have been in the early 2000s. And I'm glad we're getting more aware of this now and we're starting to make this more aware, but I wish we could have been more honest and real of feelings we were feeling when we were growing up, because being real and honest in that moment helps us get it out. And being ourselves, like, and also being ourselves without, and I wish there was more inclusion at that time too. And I wish there was more inclusion. And I wish, because I wasn't able to vocalize my feelings or express myself when I was a kid. And I wish I was able to vocalize what I was feeling and handle those feelings sooner rather than later. But at the same time, I didn't know how. So I didn't know how to do it till I got older. And so I definitely do wish that. Definitely wish when I was younger I knew how, but I didn't, which is okay. So we eventually learn and we grow from it, and we will, and it gets better.
Oh my gosh, what a beautiful way to end this panel discussion. It's really been a pleasure sitting here speaking with each of you. I thank you for being so honest and open. At this time, I'm going to go ahead and pass it back to, I think it was Penny, or no, Carolyn, excuse me. And she's going to close us out. Thank you all again.
I want to thank our incredible panel for joining us today at Autism Conversations. I also want to thank you, the listeners, for tuning in for this wonderful conversation. If you are interested in hearing more Autism Conversation podcasts, we invite you to check us out on the Autism Programs portal, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. If you are in New Mexico and are seeking autism-based resources and supports, please contact the Autism Family and Provider Resource Team at 505-272-1852. Also, if you are on social media, please visit the UNM Center for Development and Disability Facebook page. Be sure to like our page and follow us. This is Savannah Oster, along with the Autism Conversations team, and we hope you join us again for our next Autism Conversation.